Good evening. Thank you for being here. The sermon this morning got quite a nice response from folks, it seemed like, so I thought I'd go ahead and finish it. If you're catching up in the middle and you're following along on the outline, I think I left off with the very last line on the first page. I'm getting some nodding heads, so that appears to be the case. You never know how you're going to come across in these kind of things. What kind of impressions you're going to leave. I gather from a comment that was made in our men's study in the previous hour, not sure about this, but it sounded like I was being accused of being some kind of expert on the subject of parenting. And more to the point, the implication seems to have been made that I was promoting myself as such, and such is not the case by any stretch of the imagination. As the old debaters used to say, I resent the allegation and I challenge the alligator. Yeah, that's not what I was going for at all. On the other side, someone had suggested that I had begun the lesson by talking about child rearing, and we're going to talk about child rearing some and my devotion to that topic, and very quickly segued into the topic of planting, like actual plants, in my history of that and all the plants that I'd killed over the years. And I guess maybe the implication was drawn that there might be a corpse somewhere of some child that I'd forgotten to feed or something like that. I don't know. But to my knowledge, there is not. As far as you know, there's not. So that's the important thing. Again, the point of the lesson is to try to focus on ourselves as people, as human beings, as Christians, and try to see ourselves in the role of a servant of Christ who happens to have children, as the case may be. And the children may be young, the children may be grown, the children may be prospective. You know, we may not be parents yet. Or we may be talking about the children of our children. We may be talking about the other people's children that we happen to have some kind of influence over, some kind of connection with. In any case, what are we planting along with these children? What are we giving them to encourage spiritual growth in them? What kind of impulses? Are they good impulses? Are they bad impulses? We're going to try to talk about a couple of other good impulses, then we'll talk about some bad ones as we close up. I want to talk about an ethic of work first. And this is one of those topics that the young people don't especially enjoy sermons on young people and parenting and that sort of thing. It tends to lead to awkward conversations on the way home and that sort of thing. And when the conversation turns to work, well, then that's two strikes right there. You know, for most teenagers, work is a four-letter word. I get that. It was for me, too. Nevertheless, parents do their children a tremendous service when they instill in them early on an appreciation for the concept of work. And that work may take different forms. It may be sweeping the kitchen floor. It may be feeding the dog or taking the trash out. It may be cutting the grass or washing the windows or whatever. There's any number of things that you can do. Getting a paper route, getting a part-time job when you get to be old enough for that sort of thing, whatever. But in any case, an acknowledgement of work as being a noble thing, a good thing, something that in fact we were put here on earth to do in large measure. This is something that they learn from us, or don't learn, as the case may be. What kind of attitude do we take as adults with regard to work? And again, I talked a little bit about my father and his work background. I've had some jobs in my past that I wasn't especially thrilled with. Maybe you have too. And it's very easy to take a rather negative attitude, not just toward the particular day or even the particular job, but also toward work as a concept. And we need to make sure that we don't do that for our children, because work is a noble thing. It's something that has been given to us by God. It's a blessing, in fact, from God, and should be seen as such. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we'll refer to several passages in Ecclesiastes here this evening, chapter 3 and verse number 12, Solomon says here, "I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime." And he's been talking about the time for this and the time for that. You know the passage. And the emphasis here on the appropriateness of things in their place. He says there's always a time for work. There is always a time for a proper value with regard to such things. To do good in one's lifetime. And to be joyful when you're doing it. And I realize this can be a bit of a burden for grown-ups. Especially grown-ups who maybe work extended hours or work in a very uncomfortable career or job or whatever. I get that. I've heard illustrations of a man who maybe is a lawyer or some kind of high-pressure kind of job. And he was seen coming to his house and leaning on the tree in his front yard, and just kind of leaning there for about 30 seconds or so, just like he's going to knock it down or something like that. And then going into his house. And when the guy with his carpool had asked him about that later, he said, "That's my troubles tree. That's where I go there when I get home. And all the troubles that I found in my day at work, I put them on that tree. And I leave them there before I go into the house. And I found that when I come back out the next morning, there aren't as many of them there as there was when I dropped them off the night before," which I think is kind of a neat story. And a good illustration for us that we can do our children a tremendous disservice when we teach them implicitly or explicitly that work is a burden, it's a problem, something to be avoided, quite frankly. Do we portray work as being a curse? Now, I realize that the word curse and the word work are put together a lot, and there's a biblical precedent for that. When you go back to Genesis chapter 3, there is a curse placed upon the ground. There's a curse that's placed upon mankind. But you can look here, you know, through the text from here until eternity. I don't think you're going to find a curse placed on work in that context. It's not work that's being cursed. Work receives consequences that, as far as we know, it did not have prior to this point. Work is going to be more challenging than perhaps it would have been otherwise. Nevertheless, it is still our responsibility to labor and to work hard. In the sweat of our brow, he says, you're going to eat bread. It's supposed to be a burden. That's why they call it work, right? Because it's a challenge. It's uncomfortable. We would rather not do it, but we do it anyway because God thinks this is the way that we ennoble ourselves. By giving of ourselves for our physical needs, for our future, and for our family. Not to mention, of course, being a good example of godly things for others, including and particularly our children. Check yourself for work. Check to see if you are, in fact, having the right kind of attitude toward such things. What is our attitude toward work? Do you do the best that you can do in all that you do? I referred to Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10 this morning. I think it fits maybe even better here in the context tonight. Whatever your hand finds to do, he says, do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. I had jobs, and you probably have too, especially as a young person, where there wasn't especially a whole lot asked of you. There was not a great deal of direct oversight. The boss might not even be on site at any given time. And the temptation is always to get away with whatever you think you can get away with. It's a natural human impulse. Most of us at least think about doing that kind of thing. In our nobler moments, we work anyway. Not because the boss is going to find out somehow or another and get us fired, although he might. But because work is noble, because work is good. We're supposed to be doing these things. And whatever we find to do, he says, do it with our might. If something is worth our attention, it's worth our devotion. It's worth our energy. I tell my daughters all the time, you know, if you can figure out how to show up on time to your job and give it your all and be friendly to people, be cooperative, be respectful to your boss, you will have a job as long as you want a job. Because people love that. And it's getting a little rare, as far as I can tell, from my experience in the lines at various fast food operations in town. That work and doing it with your might, that's what we need to be doing for our children. Not just working in the home, obviously, although that's relevant, but working in our workplace. Being enthusiastic about our job. Being enthusiastic about the opportunity for a job. You know, we live in an environment, quite frankly, to put it bluntly, where a lot of people don't have jobs and would like to have jobs. Doesn't seem appropriate, really, for us to be complaining about the particular work we have to do when a lot of other people don't have any work at all and wish they did. Do you give yourself excuses? Do you write yourself a pass for substandard work? Well, it's not that big of a deal, or oh, we'll just cover it with a coat of paint and nobody's going to know the difference, or I'll be long gone before this ever shows up, or whatever. Do you remember in our Bible class hour a few weeks ago, we talked about the parable of the plasterers that's described in Ezekiel chapter 13, and I can just imagine these people showing up and getting paid ahead of time, apparently, to build this wall, and it's just too much of a hassle to make sure the wall stays together. We'll just give a good coat of paint, it's going to look all pretty, and then we're going to leave town with our money, and it's going to fall apart, and they're going to say, well, what happened? And we'll be long gone, and the money will be just as good. Well, that's not the kind of work ethic that we need to have, is it? We need to be more noble than that, more diligent than that. Proverbs 26 and verse number 13. The sluggard says, there is a lion in the street, a lion in the open square. This is another passage that we talked about in our Bible study as well. This notion of a sluggard looking for excuses to stay home from work, looking for excuses to not do what is expected of him. I don't know, there's a lot of traffic out there today. I might get run over. Yeah, I better stay home. All right. I may be coming down with something. I think I better stay home. Or, you know, whatever it happens to be. There's always something. If you want to find an excuse to not work, there are going to be plenty of excuses out there. The question is, do we want an excuse or do we want the work? Now, there are going to be some situations that come up, and you know it as well as I do, where work is just not reasonable. Where, because it's going to injury or health or a personal crisis or whatever it happens to be, it's not possible under any reasonable estimation for us to go into work. People understand that. And even if they don't, God understands that. That's the exception, not the rule, and we all know that. We need to find ways of giving ourselves to the tasks that God, as well as our employers, have put to us. Do we wrestle with passivity? Which I guess is a nice term for laziness. You know, it's so much, you know, the law of inertia. The physics students know about the law of inertia, right? The things that are in motion tend to stay in motion. That's a good thing, is for our purposes here. If you're working, if you're diligent, then you tend to stay at work. The old mantra is, if you need something done, give it to somebody who's busy. That's people who work, they're going to stay in work mode. On the other hand, things that are stationary tend to stay stationary. That's just kind of the way that it works. Likewise, if we are going to be diligent about work, especially spiritual work, then we have to get to it and we have to keep to it. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, Paul says in Philippians 2, verse 12. The work that we are to do that backs up our faith, James alludes to in James chapter 2 and verse number 14. The faith that doesn't have any works, what difference is that going to make? Is that going to do good for anybody? The work that we do, carnal work, spiritual work, family work, however you want to look at it, the things that we do to exert ourselves on God's behalf, on our family's behalf, this is a way of demonstrating the kind of person that we are. And this kind of attitude will trickle down to our family. It'll trickle down to our children and to our grandchildren as they see our ethic. You know, I remember watching my dad driving us out to the country to help my granddad tend to his yard and his garden. And, you know, my brother and I, you know, we didn't ask him to plant all these potatoes. You know, and I don't know who's going to eat them as far as that goes. Why should we have to go and dig up all these potatoes? Why didn't Papa do it? Well, Papa is 80 years old. That's one reason. Well, and there's other things involved. You've all done chores for your parents and your grandparents before. You know what I'm talking about. I'm sure that a big part of the reason Dad put us through that was simply so that we would have something productive to do, so that we would be busy about something noble, serving somebody else. That's a good thing for us to do and something that we need to be busy about as much as is possible. I'll give you one other one before we talk about the negatives. Priority of service. And I'm tempted to just take Brother Larry's outline from our class this last hour and just kind of read all the passages that he put together. He had a lot more on his handouts than I'm going to have on my slides up here, but you've already got your outlines and you're trying to fill that out, so I'll just stick with what I already prepared, I guess. But the Bible is just replete with information about service, and we just don't have any excuse as far as this goes. If you have gotten this far in your spiritual development and you haven't figured out yet that you're supposed to be serving people, then today's your lucky day. You're going to find out what the Bible teaches on the idea of service. You're supposed to do it. You're supposed to do it a lot. You're supposed to do it all the time, in fact. Serve your family. Serve your neighbors. Serve the church. Serve God, of course, most of all. It's who we are. Now, serve is one of those words that's not especially popular in our society. Well, you know what? I'm not sure there's ever been a society where serving was popular. We get over that. We move on. Because we realize, even in our most selfish moments, service is absolutely mandatory if a society is to function. We don't like to be the one who's doing the serving, but if nobody is doing the serving, then woe be to us. Imagine if you're at dinner, and you know the food's placed in front of you, and the spoon is in the casserole dish, and okay, here we go. Who's going to serve? Well, I'm not going to serve. I'm not going to serve. I'm not going to serve. And we just sit around and starve to death in our four chairs at the dining room. Well, that's not likely to happen, is it? Not in my family. Now, maybe it's different in your place. I don't know. We find somebody to serve, and we're all happy about it. Maybe the next time it's somebody else's turn to serve, or whatever. The idea is that we have an obligation, a community obligation, to put others before ourselves. Sometimes it's a temporary kind of thing. Sometimes it's a permanent kind of thing. But either way, it's a serving kind of thing. Do our children see us doing that? Do they see us putting others before ourselves? Do we talk about it? Do we, maybe not brag about it exactly, but publicize it to our children? We don't necessarily want to go around the neighborhood bragging about how many people we've helped this month or whatever. But tell your children about it. That's okay. This is what we're doing. This is why we do it. Because it's our obligation, it's our duty, it's our privilege, in fact, to live our lives in service. We read from Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 and following, but some of you weren't here for that, so we'll read it again. In Philippians chapter 2, and this is, you know, anytime Jesus is given to us as an example, I suppose we ought to just kind of perk up and listen, right? Well, here Jesus is an example of service. Do nothing, Paul says in verse number 3. Philippians 2, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with a humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus. And he goes on to describe that attitude of service that Jesus exemplified in his life. What kind of a servant Jesus was? Well, you don't need me to tell you that. Him coming to the earth initially should have been all the impulse that we should need to tell us what kind of a servant Jesus was. And every day of his life after that was spent in service. Going to the cross, of course, the ultimate act of service. Well, now what are we going to do? Well, I'm too busy with my stuff right now. I got too many irons in the fire right now. I got to take care of me for right now. And when I'm done taking care of me, then I'll maybe get around talking about maybe helping somebody else. Let me tell you something. You're never going to be done taking care of you. You're going to wake up tomorrow with brand new problems, brand new issues, just as urgent as the things that you're addressing today. Nothing's going to change. We have to ignore all of that and do what the Bible's telling us to do. Let's say that again. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. Nothing, he says. It's not about me. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, he says. I skipped a verse there. With humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Now, if you get that part right, you don't have to worry about the rest of it. If you figure out that it's more important for me to take care of somebody else than take care of me, then I'll spend the rest of my life taking care of others like I would have otherwise taken care of myself. Well, but see, the problem is I don't want to do that. Well, I'm aware you don't want to do that. You know why? Because I don't want to do that. None of us does. We come programmed with this incredible self-defense mechanism. We are programmed to take care of ourselves. And the test of our character comes in when God asks us to overcome that and think about somebody else. And then the next day, think about somebody else. And then somebody else after that. Is that how we live our life? Do our children see us living our life that way? Or do we expect others to serve us? Another passage we alluded to in John chapter 13, where Jesus washes the feet of the disciples, and they're, to put it mildly, taken aback by this, this incredible act of service. And I say incredible, it's not incredible, I guess. It's just kind of disgusting. And certainly beneath the dignity of a master, rabbi, teacher like Jesus. And Peter's not having it. You're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus explains, no, this is the way it has to be. And Peter submits. He allows Jesus to serve him. And then Jesus makes the application. Verse number 14. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. And then he says in verse 16. I love this. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. Now, back then, washing feet was slave's work, typically. Sometimes if the master of the house wanted to make a very good impression, he might do it himself. Generally speaking, it was done by a slave. Now, you can imagine what would happen if on day one of the party, the master washed everybody's feet. And then the same people came back the next day, and he told the slave, okay, it's your turn to wash feet. He says, I'm not washing feet. Ick. That's beneath my dignity. I don't think I'm going to do that. I didn't sign on for that. How can you say that? The master was just washing feet yesterday, but it's too gross for you to do it? Too undignified for you to do it? Now, I don't believe there's a mandate here for us to physically wash one another's feet in a literal sort of sense. I think the point is a broader one than this. That we need to live lives of service. It was not too undignified for Jesus to do it. It should not be too undignified for us to do it. We need to swallow our pride and get about the act of helping somebody else. Now, there may be somebody in the audience here this evening who is saying, boy, you just give it to them, Hal. Oh, yeah, that's right. This group really needs to serve. And I know they need to serve because I don't ever get served. There's a whole line of people out there that are busy 24 hours a day not serving me. You know, shame on them. It's about time that somebody jumped on their case a little bit. And hopefully, after a real, you know, kick in the pants like this, somebody's going to come around to actually doing what they're supposed to do and serve me. That is not the point I'm trying to make here. Please disabuse yourself of that notion. I'm not saying that your brethren are delinquent in their efforts or non-efforts in serving you. I am saying that you, as an individual, regardless of who you are, where you are, how old you are, how young, how talented, how decrepit, anything, you have an obligation to serve somebody else. From God, not from me, not from the church, from God. And if you choose, by the way, on a side note, to not avail yourself of that, if you choose not to serve your fellow man, I don't know how you could possibly stand in judgment for them taking the same exact attitude that you have. How exactly is that supposed to work? If you want to be selfish, if you want to be only concerned about yourself, and we all have concerns. You may think yours are more or less than somebody else. We all have concerns. If you want to be consumed with those to the point where you don't help anybody else, please at least do the rest of the courtesy of not judging them. Because every single one of us is supposed to serve. Find somebody to serve. I've beat that drum enough over the last few months. I'll leave it at that. Check yourself. Are you, in fact, serving? Are you a serving kind of person? You demonstrate yourself to your children as being servant kind of people. Do you measure worth by the personal benefit that you accrue from something? I'd be glad to serve if there was a check in it for me. Well, you know what? There's a lot of people out there who would be very willing to serve if they had a check. But that's not really service, is it? That's not really what the Lord's talking about. In Acts 20, verse number 35, the only little trivia question here for you, the only thing that Jesus said that is not recorded for us in so many words in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Is recorded for us in Acts chapter 20, verse 35. Apostle Paul, by inspiration, tells us that Jesus said, it is better to give than to receive. Well, do we believe him or not? If we believe him, if we really believe that Jesus was right, and he was right a lot, if we believe that it's better to give than to receive, then let's check to make sure that we are giving for the sake of giving. Again, it's easy to give when we have the opportunity to receive in return. That's not what we're talking about here. Do you prioritize giving? Is it important to you? Do you see it as an extension of your character? Do you see it as a demonstration of your connection to Jesus Christ? That's what Paul is trying to say in the text that we read earlier in by way of introductions this evening. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and we talk about this text a lot with regard to the contribution on Sunday mornings. And that's fine. I think that has excellent application there, but not just there. Think of this text in terms of spiritual activity at large, or values in generally. The one who sows sparingly will reap sparingly. The one who sows bountifully will reap bountifully, he says in verse number 6. That's pretty straightforward, right? If you plant half your field, you're going to harvest half your field. Plant your whole field, you're going to harvest your whole field. All things being equal. That's just kind of common sense. How much are we investing in our brethren? How much are we investing in our family? How much are we serving? Are we committed to serving? Are we sowing to serving deeply or shallowly? And I love the way that he goes on to say in this same context in verse number 8 there, God is able to make all grace abound to you so that you will, having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. As it is written, and then he quotes from the Psalms there, he scattered abroad, talking about the righteous soul. He scattered abroad, he gave to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. This is the righteous one, taking his lead from the Lord, giving because God gives, loving because God loves. And he says in verse number 10, now he who sowed supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. Where do you think that stuff that you're giving away comes from? You know, you want to go serve somebody else with your time, with your money, with your food, whatever it happens to be. Where did that come from? Didn't it come from God? If it came from God, doesn't it make sense to, A, use it for God's purposes, and B, trust him to fill in the blanks if you accidentally give it too much? Do we sometimes use that as an excuse for not serving? If I'm worried that I'm going to serve so much that I'm not going to have enough to take care of me. Well, you're a more noble person than I am. I'll tell you that. But let me assure you, that's not likely to happen. Our God is a gracious and loving God, and I have yet to find somebody who served themselves into financial oblivion. David says in, was it Psalm 33:25? Now I got to know. I have been young, and now I am old. 37, verse 25. I have been young, and now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread. What a great statement that is. I've been around a long time, David says. This is the way that it works. God takes care of his people. And when God's people are generous, when God's people serve, God still takes care of them. That's pretty neat. Do you serve those who do not serve in return? Because that's the way that it's supposed to work. You can look at serving as being an investment, if you want. See, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick out a nice family, and I'm going to have them over for dinner. And I'm going to cook them a really nice meal. And they're going to feel pretty good, and maybe a little bit guilty, because they haven't had me over. And so a couple of weeks are going to go by, and they're going to invite me over to their house. And they're going to treat me at least as good as I treated them, and probably a little bit better. And so the end, I come out ahead. And if I actually have a good time with my brethren in the process, so much the better. Well, that's one way to do it. But let me suggest to you, that's not what the Bible means by service. That's not what the Bible means by hospitality. Serving, particularly, is for those who need service and almost by definition are not in position to serve in return. Luke chapter 14. Jesus says in verse number 12, he went on to say to the one who had invited him, he's at dinner. Jesus must have been a pretty awkward dinner guest sometimes. He said, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors. Otherwise, they will invite you in return and that will be your repayment. Don't do that, he says. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed since they do not have means to repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Now, I don't think Jesus means here that you're not allowed to have decent middle-class people over for dinner once in a while. I don't think that's the point. Nor is it the point that you're obligated to find everybody who's destitute and bring them over for dinner. I don't think that's the point either. But the point is this. We serve for service's sake. We don't serve for self-serving sake. That's a lot of S's. But you know what I mean. We are not serving so that we ourselves will be served. That's exactly the opposite of Bible service. We serve because it's the right thing to do. Because there are people who need our help. They need our encouragement. And we are eager to offer that at whatever opportunity that we have. Now, that's basically the lesson. Let me close by talking a little bit about the negative. It may be that instead of planting your little plants with nourishment, with mulch, with Miracle-Gro and all that kind of good stuff, that instead of planting all the good stuff, you're planting poison. Now, it ought to stand to reason that if you plant your plants with poison, they got a better chance of dying than if you don't plant it with poison. That's called setting yourself up for failure. Now, maybe they won't die. They may survive, but it'll be despite your efforts instead of because of them. Let's ask myself, are we in fact planting seeds of destruction? Are we setting our children up for failure instead of success? And I'll give you a few examples of how this might work. Do you try to take away their problems? Uh-oh, I don't like the way this is going because I really want to answer yes to that. I'm supposed to take away their problems, aren't I? To a certain extent, yes. What I mean by that is this. There is a philosophy of parenting that considers any kind of bad news in the life of their children to be intolerable and to be avoided at all costs. When they are treated poorly at school, when they get an unfair grade, when they are not properly appreciated, when they lose the student election or whatever it happens to be, then things have just gone horribly wrong. And we need to hover over them and pat them on the head and tell them how wonderful they are and how they were horribly, horribly treated and set them up where, you know, maybe we'll buy some boats the next time. Or maybe we'll just, pack the court somehow or another where they cannot possibly fail. And in so doing, we teach these children that the world is supposed to work the right way. And it doesn't. Jesus, I think, three times in the book of John calls the devil the prince of this world. If the devil is running the world, how do you think that's going to work out for the people who don't like the devil? People who are opposed to the devil, who are trying to stop the devil from getting things done. Don't you kind of figure that we're going to get at least our share of bad news and maybe more than our share of bad news? That's been my experience. It's been my children's experience. I could regale you with some personal anecdotes that would horribly humiliate them, but that's not the point. The point is what you already know. Bad things happen in the world. You're going to get your thorn in the flesh. And sometimes, as was the case with the Apostle Paul, the proper response to this is not to do everything in your power to take care of that thorn. Get rid of that thorn so they can get back to a normal, peaceful, happy way of life. Maybe the solution is teach them how to deal with it. Teach them about bigger priorities. Teach them about patience, about the role of suffering, about trusting in others. That's what Paul had to learn. He didn't want to learn it. He asked three times not to be forced to learn it. Jesus says, no, you're going to do it my way. And he learned to appreciate the value in failure, the value in pain. And this is tough for parents. This is tough for me and Tracy to balance this, because we want to help our children avoid pain just like any loving parent would. But we know we can't do that completely. And there's a certain point at which we stop our efforts. And we try to turn it into a lesson. No, it's not fair. But you know what? You're going to be okay. You can tough it out. You can survive this. And the lessons that you learn here in your teenage years, when it looks like the world is coming to an end, are going to be valuable and important lessons later on. When really bad stuff happens. The teenagers don't like hearing this when I tell them, but you're only getting warmed up with the problems. It gets a lot worse than this. A lot worse. And in that day, if your parents have done their job, you have learned how to deal with adversity instead of having somebody else artificially lift you out of adversity. Do we empower our children to endure? Do we give them what they need, what they really need? They don't need relief. They need Jesus Christ. That's what they need. I can do all things, Paul says. And I realize he wasn't a teenager when he wrote it, but this was his attitude. It needs to be our attitude. I can do all things, he says, through him who strengthens me. That's not talking about getting out of problems. That's about powering your way through problems. You can succeed in this. It may not be comfortable. It quite likely won't be comfortable. Remember, Paul's writing this from prison. He's got chains on his hands when he's writing this out. Life will deal you a bad hand sometimes. You can persevere. And your parents aren't doing you any favors when they rob you of an opportunity to learn how to persevere. Point number two, do you excuse their failures? I like to think that I am relatively open-minded about my children. I know every parent says that. And most parents are wrong when they say it. Maybe I'm wrong. But I am aware that my children have failings. I'm aware that my children make mistakes. I'm aware that my children underachieve from time to time. I'm not okay with that, but it's not the end of the world either. The trick is to allow them to learn from their failures. And you hear one motivational speaker after another say this, and I say it too. You've heard other people say it. We learn more from our failures than we learn from our successes. Now, if that's the case, if you really believe that, if you really believe that you learn more from your failures than from your successes, why would you rob your children of their failures? I'm not saying you celebrate failure. I'm not saying you celebrate underachievement. But to turn a blind eye toward our children's mistakes is not going to do them any service in the long run. The one talent man, as we sometimes call him, failed. Because he didn't try. And that's the way failure happens a lot. We just don't try very hard. Well, he didn't try at all. Master, I knew you'd be a hard man, reaping where you didn't sow and gather where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, he says. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. See what you have, what is yours. Look at me. I didn't lose anything. Well, that didn't mean he didn't fail. And his master did not pat him on the head and say, well, I really kind of expect a little bit more out of you, anything. But you weren't up for it, and that's okay. Well, maybe we'll just give you a raise, just like I gave to the other guys, and we'll try again next time. No, it didn't work that way. This man got fired. He was incompetent. Now, I'm not saying you should fire your kids. But I am suggesting
that when our children are not up to standard, whether it's in school, whether it's in the home, whether it's in their personal life, their morality, whatever it happens to be, when they are not up to our standards, and more to the point, when they're not up to God's standards, we point that out and we use it as an opportunity to grow. You can and you must do better than this. And if you don't do better next time, that's okay. We'll take it from the top again. But none of that is going to happen if we make excuses for our kids all the time. It's the teacher's fault. It's the elder's fault. It's the preacher's fault. It's the neighborhood's fault. It's society's fault. You know, I hear a lot about this, and I'm about to decide I'm going to yell at somebody the next time it comes up. The notion that our children have it so much worse than other people's, you know, other generations' children. Have you heard this? Have you said this? You know, I don't know. When I was growing up, we didn't have marijuana in schools, and we didn't have internet porn, and we didn't have all these other kinds of things. It just seems like our kids are just almost set up for failure. It's just so much harder on them. Well, A, I'm not so sure that's true. Yes, obviously, there are certain technological advances that have opened doors of opportunity that our children had that we didn't have. I get that. But still, bad things were available to us. Bad things were available to my parents, my grandparents. There's always trouble to get into if you want to get into trouble. And two, even if it is true that my children have more opportunity to mess up than I had when I was a kid, why in the world would I tell them that? Why would I set them up for an excuse? I don't want them to have a good reason to fail. I want them to succeed. And if I point out reasons why they might fail, they might avail themselves of those reasons. We need to strip away the excuses. Say, I know that it's tough. And I care. I may not act like I care, but I care. I really do. But that is not an excuse. You're going to do the right thing. You're going to do the wrong thing over my dead body. Or do we find ways to help them succeed? Do we see ourselves as empowerers for good things rather than excusers of bad things? And Proverbs is just replete with admonitions along these lines. But I'll refer you to one. In Proverbs chapter 4, and he has similar language throughout the book. Proverbs 4, starting verse number 10. Hear, my son, or daughter, in this case may be, and accept my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. I have directed you in the ways of wisdom. I have led you in upright paths. When you walk, your steps will not be impeded, and if you run, you will not stumble. Take hold of instruction. Do not let go. Guard her, for she is your life. I'm trying to save your life here, says the parent who insists that sticking a fork in the light socket is a bad idea. Climbing up on the stove when the red light is on is a bad idea. Playing in traffic is a bad idea. I was kind of half joking a while back about robbing our children of joy. A few weeks ago, I made a comment along those lines. I say that half facetiously, but the things that children want to do are not necessarily good things. Lots of times they're bad things. We want to give them good things. That's what we are always telling you about the right way to do things, as opposed to the dangerous way to do things. You need to do the one. You need to avoid doing the other. This is why parents act like parents all the time. And you get annoyed just like we got annoyed with our parents. This is not unique to you. We all went through this. All we're trying to do is set our children up, our grandchildren, for success. Empower them to make good decisions instead of making bad decisions. Do you give them what they want? Well, again, is that such a bad thing? Yeah. And I'll tell you why. Because your children want things that are in their best interest for the next 5 seconds. And you're trying to provide for them for the next 5 decades. And those two goals are not necessarily compatible. In fact, oftentimes, if not most times, they are absolutely incompatible. And we touched on this not too long ago. Don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. But look what the Hebrew writer tells us about discipline.
in verse number 7 and following of chapter 12. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which you have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best to them. But he disciplines us for our good, so that we may share in his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness.
We don't like it when we get disciplined by our parents. But you know what discipline is? You know, discipline is taken from the same root word that the word disciple comes from. It's a learner, a follower. You're learning how to be a human being. You think you got it licked by the time you're 14. You don't. And when you turn 16 or 18 or 21, you're still not going to get it. It's not possible for you to get it. It's not your fault. It's just the way the world works. Your parents provide discipline so that you can survive. And the discipline looks like they hate you. But they don't. They love you. And that's why they do the mean thing. I heard a story just this week about one of these lecturer guys was talking about a person that they'd come across at a college campus. Let's see if I can tell the story right. He said that he'd run into this young man, and he was telling his story. He said that when he was 15 years old, his parents said, "We're going to give you a roof over your head, food on your plate, and $50 a week. The rest is up to you." Got some real terrified looks down here on the front row. It's like, are you kidding me? Everything, clothing costs, transportation costs, entertainment costs, obviously. All of this. Do whatever you want, but do it on $50 a week. That's it. He said that young man was, at that time, on full scholarship at a very prominent university, $20,000 in savings in the bank. He said, "I hated it at the moment. But it was the best thing my parents ever did." Now I realize that our young people are just terrified now. They think they're going to have to go start paying for their own clothing and all that kind of thing. I don't know how your parents are going to deal with this. And don't blame me if they do it the wrong way. The point is this, that when we allow our children to make decisions, when we allow them to fail in a safe environment, we allow them to grow. We allow them to become the kind of people that we want them to be. If we smother them with what we call love and protection, they'll never develop. We, in fact, wind up poisoning them by telling them that the world is going to work exactly the way they want, or that mommy and daddy are going to take care of any kind of problem that may come along. That's not disciplining them. Do we give them what they want, or do we give them what they need? There's a difference. There's not always a difference, but oftentimes there is. When we give them what they need, instruction, discipline, life lessons, we are acting the part of our Heavenly Father, who knows the right thing to do and gives it to us. When we ask him for an egg, he's not going to give us a scorpion and that kind of thing. Jesus talks about this in Luke chapter 11, verse 11 through 13. God knows how to give good gifts. We know how to give good gifts to our children also. But we give them, or should give them, the way that God gives them to us. God doesn't rain $100 bills down on our heads and call it a blessing. If that were a blessing, that's what he would do. He doesn't do that. And there's a reason for that. He gives us opportunity to work. He gives us opportunity to fail. He gives us opportunity to grow. And when we allow our children to do that, then we empower them
to ultimately make their own decisions, what they're going to do anyway, one of these days, but make them from an informed place, a spiritual place, because we put them there, because we lived that life ourselves when they were in our grasp. We continue to live that life after they leave the home, the life that God has taught us to live. We teach them to value the same things. And hopefully then, doesn't always work this way, but hopefully, we put them on a path they can stay on for the rest of their lives. We train up the child in the way that he should go. And in the end, he's not going to depart from it. That's the proverb. And hopefully, that's our story as parents. Giving the children what they need, especially when they don't want it. Be strong, parents. Stick to it. It's always easier to give them the ice cream than give them the spanking. That doesn't mean it's a good thing to do. Stick to what God has told you to do. Give the children what they need. And hopefully, in the end, they'll be like this young man that I was telling you about, who looks back at his life that was so miserable in the short term, but realized I was given the best blessing that I possibly could have been given by my parents. They helped me become the kind of person that I wanted to be. The kind of person that can turn around then and teach another generation how to grow, how to survive, and how to thrive. And especially in a spiritual environment. To be the kind of Christian that we ought to be. So that we can teach others how to do the same. We're going to encourage you to make your life right with God here this evening. If there's something you can do to conquer your battles, to win your fights instead of losing them. If there's some aspect of your life that needs to be turned over to the Lord, we haven't really talked about anything pertaining to the plan of salvation here today. But if you are in need of God's grace, we want to offer you an opportunity to reach out for it. If we can help you in any way, by helping you into the water of baptism to have your sins forgiven, by listening to your confession of fault and praying with you that you may be healed, whatever we can do to help you be the kind of Christian that you ought to be and have a hope of heaven after this life is over, please come to the front while we stand and sing to encourage you at this time.